This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
I want to start this one a little differently. No crime scene, no court records, no alleged offenses or legal timelines. I want to start with what Monique Tepe built. She married Spencer in December of 2020, a wedding in Columbus, Ohio, during a year when the world was barely functioning. And they did it anyway. They had two children. Spencer mentored a young boy named Hans through Big Brothers Big Sisters, showed up for that kid's education, his future, his life, in a way that the people around him said was consistent with who Spencer was at his core. He was a dentist whose coworkers called 911 when he didn't show up because it was that unthinkable. She was described by everyone who knew her as devoted, loving, a wonderful mother. They went to football games. They celebrated birthdays at the office. They built a home, and Monique did all of that while carrying something most people around her couldn't see. According to family members, she talked about being afraid of her ex-husband for years. Her wedding vows, as reported publicly, referenced wrong relationships and waterfalls of tears. The scars visible even on the happiest day of her new life. She didn't wait for the fear to leave before she started living. She built alongside of it, not despite it, with full knowledge of it. That's not denial. That's not recklessness. That's defiance. And it's the most human thing I've encountered in this entire case. It's just part five in our series, and it's the part that the true crime coverage almost never really touches. We talk about abuse. We talk about the escape. We talk about the fear, the system failures, the justice process. We don't talk about what comes after. Not just survival, actual healing. Not just getting out, getting yourself back. And that's what this episode is about. Because the abuse doesn't get the last word unless you let it. And the work of making sure it doesn't is the hardest, bravest, most important thing a survivor will ever do. And Monique Tepe, she was a survivor. The evil infiltrated her world, were her world again. But she did move on. She survived. I look forward to your thoughts in the comment section as we work through this, your feedback, your experiences. You can do it on Substack or on YouTube. The links are in the description. Let's start with a question nobody prepares you for. You get out, the relationship is over, the divorce is final, you're physically safe, and then one morning, you're standing in your kitchen and a thought hits you that you weren't expecting. Who am I? Not what do I do now? That's logistics. This is deeper. Who am I? What do I actually like? What do I actually think? What do I want? Not what keeps the peace. Not what avoids punishment. Not what someone else decided for me. What do I actually want? They sound like simple questions. For someone coming out of a coercive control relationship, they can feel impossible. Because the person who entered that relationship, the person with preferences and opinions and instincts and a sense of self, has been systematically dismantled. Your tastes were corrected. Your opinions were overruled. Your instincts were invalidated so many times that you stopped consulting them. Your identity was edited and re-edited until it served one function: keep your abuser calm. You didn't lose yourself all at once. It happened in micro surrenders. Each one so small, you barely noticed. You stopped listening to the music you liked because they didn't like it. You stopped wearing the clothes you chose because they had opinions. You stopped seeing the friends who made you laugh because those friends made them uncomfortable. Piece by piece, the things that made you were replaced by the things that made you manageable. And now that you're out, the original version feels like a stranger. You can't just go back to who you were before. That person has been edited so many times, the original file is corrupt. So you rebuild. Slowly. Non-linearly. Literally. Too many L's in there. None, literally, messily. You try things. You pick up an interest you dropped 5 years ago and see it if it still fits. You say yes to invitations you would have declined inside the relationship. Not because they told you to say no, but because you'd internalized their judgment so thoroughly that you felt it felt like your own. You order something at a restaurant without calculating whether it's the right choice. You wear something you want to wear and wait for the consequence. When it doesn't come, when nobody punishes you for a shirt, you feel a relief so enormous it makes you want to cry over something as small as getting dressed in the morning. I know, it sounds crazy, but until you've been there and you've had all of this autonomy slowly chiseled away from you without your knowing, you don't know what this feels like.
Oh, I'd be more accredited.
Yeah, bullshit. You can be the most aware, cognizant person in the world, and you get the wrong combination of human beings around you and your own goodwill, this can happen to anybody. It happens to people all the time. It happens to people and they never even notice it before it's far too late. If this is resonating with you, it's okay. This is the identity excavation that we're talking about. It sounds dramatic, but it happens in ordinary moments. It happens the first time you disagree with someone and they say, that's a good point. Instead of making you pay for it, instead of the silent treatment, instead of storming away, blaming you for something that's nothing to do with what's going on at that moment in time and that you still have nothing to do with. It happens the first time you say no and the world doesn't end. It happens when you realize your voice has been there the whole time. You just stopped using it because using it was dangerous and now it's not. And learning to trust that, learning to believe in your body and not just your mind and that your voice is safe to use, is the real work of recovery. Therapy helps. I'm going to be honest about that because it is true and also honest about the limitations because that's true too. Trauma-informed therapy, EMDR, somatic experiencing, cognitive processing therapy have strong clinical evidence for helping survivors of intimate partner violence process what happened to them and rebuild their sense of safety and self. It's really kind of amazing what some of this stuff can do now. If you haven't been in therapy for years and you're like, EMDR, what is, like, trust me, this shit's fucking amazing. I mean, it's really, but you got to do the work. A therapist who understands coercive control specifically, not just relationship issues, can be the difference between years of struggle and a path forward that actually works. So do your time, do your homework, find the right person. But therapy, it does cost money. It requires time. It requires finding the right clinician, someone who gets the specific dynamics of coercive control, who won't accidentally re-traumatize you by asking the wrong questions or minimizing what you went through. In many parts of this country, unfortunately, wait lists for trauma-specialized therapists are long. Insurance coverage is inconsistent at best, and some survivors aren't ready, not because they don't want to, but because the vulnerability that therapy requires demands a baseline sense of safety that they haven't established yet. You can't open the wound if you're still running from the thing that caused it. So here's the truth about therapy. If you can access it, it can change your life. Pursue it. Fight for it. And if you can't access it right now, the money isn't there, the right therapist isn't there, the readiness isn't there, that doesn't mean you're not falling or failing at recovery. Healing happens in therapy offices, yes. It also happens in friendships, in support groups, in quiet moments when you catch yourself laughing and realizing you didn't check over your shoulder first. It happens right now while you're watching this video. And realizing something about yourself and your situation, where you were and where you are now and where you're heading. It happens the first time you tell your story to someone who believes you without qualification. Healing is not a single modality. It's a process that happens wherever you can find safety, honesty, and someone who doesn't flinch when you tell them the truth. Now, when I talk about the hardest part here, shame. Let's talk about shame. Shame is the abuser's final weapon, and it's the one that keeps working long after they're gone. Survivors carry it for years, sometimes for life. Shame for staying as long as they did. Shame for not seeing it sooner. Shame for what they tolerated, what they accepted, what they normalized. Shame for what their children witnessed. Shame for needing help. Shame for not being stronger, smarter, faster, braver. Whatever world the internal voice uses to beat them on any given day. I need to say this as clearly as I know. That shame does not belong to you. It was installed by someone who needed you to believe you were the problem. Every time they made you feel stupid, complicit, deserving of what was happening, they were constructing a prison inside your own mind that would outlast the relationship, and it has. You carried it out the door with you. You carried it into your new life. You carry it right now, maybe even listening to this. Put it down. Not all at once. I know it doesn't work that way, but piece by piece, by telling your story to someone safe and watching their face confirm what you've been afraid to believe. That what happened to you was wrong. It was not your fault. By meeting another survivor in a group online, in the comment section of this video, in a conversation you didn't expect, and recognizing your experience in theirs, by slowly, painfully accepting that what happened to you reveals nothing about your worth and everything about the character of the person who did it. If you go back in part three of this series, we talked about the question, why didn't she just leave? You know, that stupid statement that people make. The cultural blame that gets aimed at victims from the outside. That's the external version. What I'm talking about now is the internal version, the distorted mirror the abuser left behind. The reflection that says you're weak, stupid, broken, or used up. Healing means replacing that mirror, finding one that reflects who you actually are, and learning to trust what you actually see in it. There's a skill that nobody teaches survivors and everybody needs, boundaries. Inside a coercive control relationship, boundaries were crimes. Setting a limit, saying, I don't want to, saying that's not okay, saying no, invited punishment, rage, retaliation, withdrawal. You learned that having needs was dangerous, that asserting yourself was the fastest way to make things worse. So you stopped. You erased your own boundaries so thoroughly that by the time you got out, you couldn't remember having them. Rebuilding that muscle is terrifying. Your body remembers what happens last time you said no, but this is where the real reconstruction happens in the daily mundane acts of saying, this is what I need, and this is what I won't accept, and discovering that healthy people don't punish you for having limits, they respect them. Every time you set a boundary and it holds, every time you assert a need and the response is understanding instead of violence, you get back a piece of yourself that was taken. It's small, it's slow, and it's the most important work you will ever do. You're not alone in this. One in three women and one in four men experience some form of intimate partner violence in their lifetime. The numbers for coercive control are almost certainly higher because it remains dramatically underreported and underrecognized. There are people in your life right now who understand exactly what you've been through. You may not even know it because they carry the same silence you do. Support groups exist, survivor networks exist, online communities exist, where people who've lived this talk to each other with a level of understanding that no clinical intervention can replicate. When someone who's been through it looks at you and says, I know. That two-word sentence does more than a year of well-meaning advice from someone who hasn't. You are not what happened to you. Monique Tepe wasn't defined by the 7 months she allegedly spent in terror. She was defined by what she did after. She chose love again. She chose Spencer. She chose parenthood. She chose to build a home with someone who mentored kids and cared about his community and showed up every single day. She chose joy even while carrying fear. She chose to live fully, openly, bravely, even though her nervous system was still scanning for danger every hour of every day. This is not foolishness. That is the most courageous thing a human being can do, to build a life worth living after someone tried to convince you that your life wasn't yours to live. To become fully, unapologetically yourself after someone spent months or years trying to erase you. To love again after love was used as a weapon against you. You are not the names you were called. You are not the rules you followed. You are not the fear you carried. You are not the shame you were made to feel. You are what you build after. And building is a choice you can make today. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence or coercive control, there's a phone number you can call, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, available 24/7 at 1-800-799-7233. Love to get your thoughts, your feedback, your stories. Share them in the comment section. If you don't even want to share, just check out the comment section, because I can guarantee you there's a lot of people there that are in your same boat, that are sharing stories, that are there, that care. You're not alone. Share your story if you're comfortable. Help another person feel a little more normal. The links to our Substack and YouTube are in the description. Love for you to join us on either of those platforms and weigh in. If you're on Apple Podcasts, be sure to press subscribe and leave us a review. Your feedback, if this is valuable to you, through an Apple Podcast review, helps other folks find us. So thank you so much for that. We do greatly appreciate your feedback there and your support. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.